Yes, that's right. Yes, that's a good thing. Yes.
Right, should we start, because we're running over time, and now Jan's here, we're only waiting for Morris. And I would suggest that people towards the back might want to move a bit further forward. It feels a bit weird sitting here and staring at you all fading into the distance. For those who don't know, I'm Ruth Cadbury, new Labour MP for Brentford and Isleworth in West London. Labour game from Tories. I think I wasn't the originally advertised chair, so you may not be aware of my name, probably wasn't on the original billing. And I've had an association with Fabians over the years, mainly funding some of the work they did as a chair of the Barrow Cadbury Trust, which is a social justice foundation. So I'm really pleased. We've got two of our three speakers here today on the topic of citizenship, contribution and responsibility. Is the left ready for a new social contract? Do we want to have a re-look at everything around rights and responsibilities? Did we get it right in the last election this year or not? I suppose for me is, what's our language going to be? The Tories had the language of the big society, which died a death almost as quickly as it emerged. We can surely do better than that. And we've got three very good and very experienced speakers. And I'm going to start off by asking Tracy Paul to speak. She is the policy manager of the NCS Trust, and more of us will come across 15 to 17 year olds in our communities, working hard, learning skills, engaging in community activity. So I think I'll go straight over to Tracy to tell us a bit more.
Thank you very much. So as Ruth said, my name's Tracy. I'm the policy manager for NCS Trust. I was hoping to be following Mr. Glassman, so I'll just kick off. Before I do, I just wanted to say, some of you won't know what National Citizens Service is, and I'm going to say a little bit in my remarks about it. But it was a big society initiative by David Cameron in the 2010 election. And I was recruited to NCS to try and talk to Labour about the programme. I have to say that because of Jan and all the things that she thought and felt about the programme, NCS was put into Labour's manifesto, which was a massive, massive achievement, and was a real example of where somebody good did something good, whichever side of the political spectrum that good idea came from, that Labour were able to say, no, we recognise good things when we see it. A couple of Labour politicians said, we should have done a programme like this. And it was Jan who drove forward the commitment from Labour to the programme. And, I mean, for us, that is the most fantastic achievement. And for the young people, it means that this programme is going to run and run and run because it's got the support of Conservative, Labour and Tories. And we just want to say thank you so much for doing that for the young people.
Thank you.
So we're meeting here with the backdrop of new politics, and obviously it's not just our party that's changing, and it's a strange time to be involved in politics. And the title of this event is the Left Ready for a New Social Contract? And I would assert that the left has no choice but to be ready for a new social contract, because the world is changing, expectations are changing, the way people behave at work and through their social lives are changing. And I think it's up to us that we need to. We're the party of the future. We're always relentlessly about the ideas for the future. And so it's up to us to meet the challenge of changing our public services and the way in which we work. And I want to talk about the people who I think are going to drive the most enormous amount of change in our society going forward, and that's young people. And I work for a national youth charity, which is called National Citizens Service. It's a programme for 15 to 17-year-olds. The scale of it is enormous because we get government backing. 200,000 young people have taken this programme from between 2010 and now. And to put that into context, that's 1 in 10 young people will have taken the programme, and 1 in 7 young people in London have taken the programme. And what the programme does is it brings young people together from the same local authority city area, but from different backgrounds. And it mixes them up and puts them through typically a 3 to 4 week programme, which creates challenging, life-changing experiences. And so those young people go on a massive journey together. They spend a week doing outward bound type activities, which I, for one, think is really, really great for. We're always very excited that we take a lot of young people who've never been into the country, but we also often will reintroduce sport to young girls at a point at which they're beginning to be turned off to it. They begin to do physical activity. The second week, the same groups typically go into university accommodation and they learn about independent living. So they have to cook for themselves, they have to take care of each other. They meet people from local businesses and they meet people from local charities and they begin to understand a little bit more about the world around them. And then in the third week, in a non-residential setting, they devise and implement and go on to implement a social action project, something that's going to make a massive difference in their local area. And typically those projects tend to come from two places. They tend to be either a response to something that they've seen in their local community, and that may be homelessness, that may be something to do with their own personal environment, or it comes from an experience that they've had. And there's an enormous amount of disclosure and sharing where a young person will say, my mum has this illness, or my sister has had this happen to her, and the young people will rally round together to make a response, a community response, to whatever it is that the young person has disclosed. And what it has led us to understand is that young people are enormously compassionate and powerful change agents in this country, and I think that we've got to look at how we change our public services and our social contract to actually make the most of what young people can offer. We worked with Demos to produce a report called Introducing Generation Citizen, because we were kind of quite tired of always hearing very negative views about what young people would be like. And they said to us that they were very angry that they were always being described as disaffected and non-political and not engaged, and that somehow there is a kind of job culture in this country. And so we set out with Delmas to try and find out a little bit more about young people and to find out whether this really, it didn't reflect our experience, but we wanted to do it in a more empirical way to understand whether that was their that's how they felt. We also, for a control group, we also did some survey work with their teachers, because it's, you know, young people can say we're really into this, but it's what the teachers who have the other group outside of their families who have the most direct experience of this age group. And what we got back was an amazing kind of response, in a way that we understood that young people are terribly committed as citizens in this country. They feel very passionately about politics and about change in their community, but they just don't do it in the way that we would recognise. And we're all political activists. We've all been involved in politics for a long time, some for a very long time. And they just don't behave in the same way that we did, but it doesn't mean that they don't have the same passion and the same sense of desire for change in the, as we do as political activists. They perceive themselves to be global citizens, citizens of the world, and they're as affected by something that happens, the other side of the world, as things that happen in their local communities. They attach the same significance to liking and sharing things in that we would to, marching on Downing Street. Online petitions is something that they feel very, very powerful about. And most young people, and I think we know this intrinsically in our experience of young people, that there's been an explosion in fundraising of young people going out and doing things like sponsored walks and runs and bike rides. And all of that is about giving back to the community. And it's stuff that we don't recognise as being citizenship or being political behaviour, and that's one of the challenges that I think that we've got to go. In terms of the state, they feel very, very strongly that they believe very strongly in the welfare state, but they want an enabling state and not a state that tells them what to do. And they want us to provide resources and services that enable them to take initiative and be entrepreneurial. They want opportunities to do good things. They don't want to be told this is how you behave and this is where you must go and get your services from. And 70% of them said that they wanted a career that would change the world. And I, one of the things that I feel, we all understand there are some things that we just know to be true. So career service in this country isn't right. We know that. But there is a whole concerned that even if we manage to get the structures and right in order to be able to give young people, you know, a real sense of what they could be in the future through career services, can we as a group of people actually imagine those jobs that those young people might be able to do? I don't think we can, because I don't think we understand the world. If you say to a digital native, this is how public services are going to look in 5 years' time, we are not the people who know what future public services look like. They are the people who understand a lot more and want to shape the future in the understanding of how they do it. So I think the challenge is for us is to create a new contract. We've got to encourage young people. I would say this, but you know, my experience is we've got to give them the opportunities that they want to, in order to build new public services for us that enables them to give their passion and give their creativity and all the things that we hope, because we need young people to feel committed to wanting to build a better country. But we also have to understand that they will expect those services to be available 24/7. They will expect them to be online and personal. They will expect them to be joined up and not happen in silos. They will expect services to be immediate and timely. They'll expect them to operate both on an online environment and an offline environment. And they want to be able to share their experience of public service and to be able to help guide and shape other people's experiences as well. And I think, so when we're talking about rights and responsibilities and a new social contract and what public service is going to look like in the future, I don't think it's a question of can we, do we have to reshape them. I think that young people will reshape them, and I think it's about how we as the Labour Party and people that are committed to change are the people that start creating the space and the vision for how they do it. So do we need a new social contract? Yes, we do. And are young people the right people to do it? Yes, they are.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Tracy. Okay, Jan.
Thank you very much. I think I'm a surprise person here as well, but it's a great delight to be here, especially to share a platform with Ruth, but also with Tracy, who's doing a fantastic job with the NCS. And as she said, I'm a great supporter of the NCS. I have to say that there are a few things I would like to change about it. If we'd been in government, I would like to have changed a few things about it. But it's still a jolly good thing. I was at a lunchtime meeting today with people who work in the youth sector and youth services, and people who specifically work with disadvantaged young people. And I have to say that whilst they sort of recognised some of the good things about NCS, they did say that NCS simply didn't reach the people with whom that they were working on a day-to-day basis. So I think NCS is a good thing, but it could be a better thing. And I hope that we can work with government to make it better, because I think NCS, like so many things, I think we have to build on what's there. And so I would hope that when we do get to be a Labour government, we don't sort of bin it, we just build on what's there and make it even better. So do I think, is the left ready for a new social contract? I think that most people in our party have always believed that we should focus on responsibilities as well as rights. I think that has been the norm, but it's about getting the balance right. And I think sometimes we as a party haven't always had the balance right. And certainly those who comment on our policies have suggested that we haven't got the balance right, and some people in the country think that we haven't got the balance right. But I think that rights and responsibilities go together, just as social justice and economic growth must go together. I mean, sine qua non, as it were. It is true that because of austerity, we've got to find a new way of doing things. It's happening right now that there have to be new partnerships throughout our communities, throughout society, that the public, the private, and the voluntary sectors are having to work more closely together. And this is working really, really well in some places. The problem for me is that we are having to do this, or society is having to do this, as a result of the current government believing that the power of the state or the state needs to be reduced, linked with austerity. And so it's happening, but it's not happening necessarily for the right reasons. I think, as Tracy said, that in the 21st century, we have to find a new way of doing things. I mean, we as a Labour movement, we've never stood still. We've always had to move forward and think of new ways of ensuring that our values meet the needs of whatever century we've, or whatever decade we've been in. And in the 21st century, we've got new challenges to meet, so we need to have new ways of doing things. I think the problem with the government's big society is that I like the idea of the big society, of everybody working together, all that's very good. But actually, too often they have used the big society as a means of cutting funding to organisations. And they seem to forget that the voluntary sector, which does a magnificent job and on whom we rely for so much, they can only share so much of the burden. And also a voluntary organisation, even if it's working with volunteers, it needs to have some financial support in order to have the structures there. It needs to be able to train its volunteers. And the government just doesn't think about those things. So that there are these fantastic partnerships coming into place up and down the country because of cuts. We know that youth services, for example, have been decimated. And so, but some exciting things are happening on the ground. I was hearing of some really great things happening today in Devon, with voluntaries, private, public, all working together. And in my own county of Gloucestershire, on Friday, I was at a meeting of some organisations that work with people with learning disabilities. And the county of Gloucestershire is now empowering these organisations to work by themselves, and it's giving the young, mostly young, people who've got learning disabilities, it's enabling them to have a voice and do things for themselves. That's great, but their funding is for 1 year. And, you know, I know that for that year, they're going to flourish. But after a year, what's going to happen to those organisations? Because the funding pot, I do fundraising all the time for various organisations, as everybody else here does, I'm sure. But there's only a finite amount of money that we can get from all the various trusts. And so I think there has to be a better way of doing things. And all of us who are sort of trying to get money out of trusts and organisations, sometimes we know you have to make 10, 15, 20 applications before you get any money. And that takes an awful lot of time and energy. Now, I'm not saying that the state should provide all the money. I'm absolutely not saying that. But there has to be a better way of doing things so that we can work in partnership, but without wasting all this time sort of applying for money, because sometimes it frankly does feel like a waste of time. I also think that sometimes at the moment we work in a very fragmented way. When we had the welfare state as we used to know it, you had one point of contact, and it was a sort of, now people have got to go to different organisations, and there are so many organisations working in the same field that sometimes I think that efforts get dissipated. And if we could bring some of these little organisations to work together in partnership, that would be a very good way forward. So do I think that there should be a new social contract? Yes, I do. Do I know exactly what that should be? No, I don't. There may be people here who've got, there are a lot of people here with very good ideas, but it's something that we now in opposition have really, really got to put our minds to, so that when we do get to government, we know where we want to go forward. But I do think that up and down the country, there are some local councils, Labour councils, doing a fantastic thing in delivering public services, working in partnership. And I think specifically, for example, of Lambeth and what Steve Reid did in Lambeth. And there are some great examples for us to build on. And now with decentralisation, I think that's an exciting thing as well, as long as it's not just powers that are decentralise and the funding doesn't follow. I think there's an awful lot of work to be done. In terms of young people and citizenship, I think that the work that the NCS does in telling young people about their rights as well as their responsibilities and encouraging them to become democratically engaged, I think that's a very good thing. But in terms of rights and responsibilities, we have to make sure that people know what their rights as well as their responsibilities are, or their responsibilities as well as their rights. And too often that doesn't happen. Young people, for example, when it comes to housing, jobs, health, quite often they don't know what either their rights or their responsibilities are. So somehow we've got to, I don't know, maybe we should be drawing up some sort of charter that could, you know, could have national significance so that young people know what their rights and responsibilities are. And if they've got neither, then they can go to somebody and say, look, these are my rights, these are my responsibilities. And I would finally say that sometimes we give people rights without then enabling them to exercise those rights. And I think of carers, for example. Recently, we had a bill went through Parliament about carers, and which was, I mean, it was a Conservative or Coalition bill, but it had many, many good things in it, including carers' rights to so much time, their rights to have assessment. But actually, when you drill down into it, there is no money for the carers to be able to exercise their rights, because there is no money for them to be properly assessed quite often. And even if they are properly assessed, there's no money to enable other carers to come in so that those carers can have time off. So I think that's very difficult to ensure that we kind of calibrate rights, responsibilities, but also people's expectations, because sometimes we want our young people to have aspirations, of course, but sometimes we raise people's aspirations, then we're not able to fulfil those aspirations, and that can lead to some problems. So do we need a new social contract? Yes, we do. And I think that's a big job for our party to think these things through, how to get there.
Thank you very much. Okay, as Maurice isn't here, I think it would be sensible if we opened out the floor, up to the floor, and I'd be really interested, we'd all be really interested to know if any of you have got an answer to the question, is the left ready for a new social contract? I'm looking at my fellow MP, Siobhan, first, to see if you're here to listen. Okay, you're here to listen like as I am? Yep, fine, okay. Right, a guy in the blue shirt here, and then the lady under the light, and then guy in the grey sweater there.
My name's Bryn Hollywood from the Caerphilly constituency in New South Wales. I'm a school governor, both at the high school level and the junior school level. I've got a question to put to, you know, to the party about the, you know, whilst people are still in education, because learning politics at a teenager level is non-existent. We need to get over this. It's like a brick placed in front of them. So who can do that? It's just political, but and of course, for example, I do exercises with the 11s each year about job interviews. You know. May I ask, do you know who the Prime Minister is? 7 out of 10 of them, you have a clue? Not a clue. But you know, that's got to change. Okay, we need, in my view, just the basics of how the government operates, and more importantly, I think, why people pay tax. Why do they pay tax?
Yeah.
Because of these services, whatever.
Get
what I call the kids whilst they're in school itself.
Yeah, and in my experience from my kids, who obviously did know a lot about how politics worked, they had to tell the teachers, because the teachers are often completely oblivious. You know, they'd been to school under Thatcher when Thatcher took all of the community and engagement side, PSHE. Took all of the citizenship stuff out of the syllabus. Sorry, yeah.
Daisy Serlin.
Hi, Daisy.
Previously, I was fascinated by what you were saying about young people and how actually that attitude to the welfare state could possibly be described as socially conservative in terms of their investment in it. I was just thinking, with kind of recent benefits changes like housing benefit eligibility and stuff, do you think that that will change people's investment in welfare and therefore, you know, their investment as citizens, you know, paying taxes more to fund that kind of welfare?
Okay, good question.
Yes, my name is Jonathan Boswell, Horsey of the Green Labour Party, and I was a Fabian, really, from the point I was in knee pants. That dates me. I'm fascinated because it's easier, isn't it, always to define rights than responsibilities. We can all make a list of rights, and we can all applaud the wonderful speeches in favour of rights for this, that, and the other. There are two practical issues which I think arise in this context, you know, following from the discussion, very interesting. One is national civic service, which Demos came out with a very interesting report, I think it was back in 2008, and they were taking lessons from French, German, and also a bit from the Americans, perhaps not so much from the Americans. With the idea that there might be a universal service like the national service we used to have, which I, for example, was in. So that's one thing that might be an important part of perhaps a long-term idea in the party for a contract, because it would involve not just young people, but it might involve a lot of older people as well, who've still got a lot to give to the community. So if it was looked at as a multi-generational thing, I think it might be quite exciting. The other point, which I think a friend here was raising, is about taxation. Now, taxation is horrible, isn't it? We all hate it. But it isn't, because it's an absolutely vital way of our, or one of them, committing, fulfilling our responsibilities for a decent, civilised society. Why can't we rebrand taxation? We don't want to call it something that is to do with love, because that's a lot of sloppy sentiment. But we could at least call it what it is, which is social funding.
Yeah.
It's the funding of our public services.
Yeah.
So it would be very easy to know, you know, what the panel thinks about these possibly two practical ways in which we could enlarge the concept of social contract. According to the principles of our democratic socialism.
Okay, and I'm going to cheat and ask a question as well, which is linked to sort of what Brig was saying, that you talked about 1 in 10 young people of that age group have been through NCS. Who are the 10%? Because you're obviously seeing the committed ones, the engaged ones.
Yeah.
The 90%. Who don't get involved. So,
that's
a fourth question.
I'll start. So, I completely agree with you about. I can't quite understand how we've got to a situation where political education is somehow seen to be indoctrination. I don't understand what's happened in this country and how that's happened over generation. So the common sense that we all have of how things work has just completely and utterly eroded. People don't know naturally how things work. And a Labour government did not commit to political education, putting it back on the curriculum. Obviously, David Blunkett did fantastic work in putting citizenship on the curriculum, but I do think there's some very basic things that there's just not that common understanding how things work in a collective way, which I think is really important. And actually, it falls a lot on members of parliament who end up having to do that political education themselves by going into schools and to kind of de facto kind of having to kind of teach those lessons. So I completely agree with you. I do think that young people through school are being being encouraged to be, take much more activities in their local community. And I do think that politicises people. I think the moment that young people start coming into contact with other people whose lives are not like theirs, that actually it becomes, people begin to make connections, and that learning by seeing and doing is actually much more powerful than kind of book learning. But I do think that I completely agree with you that it's becoming almost like you just can't take for granted that people understand the way that structures work, and they can't take rights or responsibilities if they don't understand the basic things that they work. In terms of Daisy's question, I don't know, Daisy. So the young people we work with, what they say is they really do feel very committed to the welfare state, but it's just not for them. Now, when you're 16, 17, 18, and obviously there will be some young people for whom they really do need the state, but for this is, as a kind of majority, when you're 16, 17, 18, I don't know if you understand what the state might provide for you either at that point in your life or in the future. And I'd be very interested to see whether the cuts to housing benefit and other things that are happening are going to really, really kind of radicalise this generation. But what I do say is that they really do believe, for instance, they're very, very committed to older people, and they really do believe that the state should care for older people, and they really understand that there are some people who don't have the same life chances as they do, and they want the state to provide for them. So it's not that they hate the state, it's just that they think they're all right, we're okay. And I think that's a great thing, because I think we should encourage their entrepreneurialism, but we've got to make certain that the collectivism that we know is so important, that factor is in there as well. In terms of Jonathan talking about national civic service, to a certain extent, that is the concept of national citizen service, but it's a short-term project. It just takes place for it's a small intervention at a significant point in young people's lives. But we are working with there are many, many brilliant organisations out there who are also looking at these same kind of issues. And one organisation is called... I've forgotten what it's called.
City Year.
That's, I've got service years written down. So it's City Year. And they are doing exactly that, which is that they are encouraging young people at the age of 18 to give up, to do a year of service. And and there's an enormous amount of it goes on in America. And a year of service, where the idea is that young people mostly go into schools. That's the model that they've got working at the moment, where they go into schools and they don't teach, they don't do a role that is done by any other existing person, but they go in and they add enormous value to the school, to the running of the school, and to the young people's lives. And as young people themselves, they develop enormously in that time. And one of the things that I feel, if I was in charge of the world for 24 hours, we'd drink a lot and it would all fall apart. But anyway, other than that, one of the things that I'd really like to see is young people are so passionate. And there's things about, say, like hospitals. We need a service year for hospitals. We need young people to be able to go into hospitals and not to spend a year not to do medical work, not to do porter work, not to take roles from other people, but to go and be passionate and compassionate in that environment. And when you talk to young people about those kind of ideas, they get very, very excited about it, because there's something about the empathy and the compassion that young people have very early on in, at that point, and we're not making the best use of that. And I would love there to be the concept of the service year. And I know that City Year are talking to the government about maybe you could have a service year as an apprenticeship, that kind of concept. Because currently you can't do that, you can't take it as an apprenticeship, but why not? And if we were really thinking about a brand new kind of social contract, then offering young people the opportunity to go in and care for other people at a point where they want to do that, I think would be a fantastic thing to do.
I completely agree about a year of service. I am a strong supporter of the sort of concept of a year of service, and I have lots of discussions with colleagues in America where they do it. Not just in America, they have the city year in schools, but they also have environmental programs, they have development programs, not just for young people, they have programs for older people who go into the community and teach and all that sort of thing. And I think that is a fantastic idea. I also think that you have NCS, which is great, and the young people have to give back, as it were, after their 3 weeks, 30 hours, I think, of service, yeah. which, frankly, I don't think is enough. And I think that there needs to be some sort of staging process that you can encourage young people to do more and more and more volunteering. There are some cracking schemes up and down the country. King's College Hospital has got a great volunteering scheme yes. where people sign up to volunteer for a year. They don't take the place of clinicians, obviously, but they go in, they read with people, they do their shopping, they do their washing if they're long-term patients, they can't get to the laundrette, and there's a lot of young people who do that as well. So that we've got this sort of nascent idea of a year of service, and I think we need to build on it. In terms of Daisy's question, which has been superbly answered, I would just say that I think the intergenerational aspect is really important. And that gets, I mean, I think that we've got to do more and more intergenerational work for young people and for older people's benefit. And that helps young people understand the benefits of sort of social service as well. Finally, on citizenship, Bryn, as Tracy said, David Blunkett introduced it. We started training teachers. We never trained enough. And what our policy was going to be was that every school should ultimately have at least one teacher trained in citizenship. So you don't have your children having to teach teachers. Because it's fundamental for young people to know about the society in which they live so that they can use that society and they understand their rights and responsibilities. I think when we were in government, we were frankly a bit too wary of what the kind of press would say, understandably, because they hammer us all the time, about, you know, well, you're teaching politics, you're teaching sort of Labour Party politics. But it's very easy to get through that. You have to ensure that, you know, you have a Tory, a Labour and a Lib Dem, they're all sort of going into schools and teaching young people about practical politics. Too many young people don't know how to vote, let alone anything else. And there are brilliant organisations like Bite the Ballot, and I would commend Bite the Ballot. I'll see you afterwards. They are brilliant. They could go into your schools.
Okay. Lady here, and then lady there. Okay, hi.
My name's Councillor
Jean,
I'm chair of Midland
Ward and the Labour Party. Very good. Solid lady.
Very.
Tracy, I wasn't in it when you started. SES sounds like a brilliant scheme, going very well. But I'd like to know whether how it's funded and how yeah. long it's funded for.
Yeah.
Because all these wonderful ideas would have come out. That's and then you get into it, getting the children all into the system, and then all of a sudden there's no money and it fizzles out.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah. Councillor Fraser from Mitchell-Millmore.
Do I spot a pattern here?
Just to say that there are a couple of things really, there are lots of volunteering happening out there. What we don't have, it seems, is a join up scheme.
Yeah.
So you don't know what I'm doing, I don't know what you're doing, nobody knows who's yeah. doing what. And so it looks like we're constantly having to restart each time. You mentioned about people working in a hospital, and you mentioned King's College. I worked yeah. there for 14 years. I was a manager there as well. And we used to have cadets. Just like you have cadet services with yeah. the police and that dialogue. Mm. So it's about sustainability yeah. and so we don't have to keep reinventing ourselves. Yeah. And lastly, among all sort of things that I do, I'm a magistrate. And I visit schools and colleges. And we visit all people's residential home, I should say, from Toronto, to talk about magistrates in the community and to encourage people to understand the schools. When I go out there with my colleagues, we actually talk to young people in primary schools about keeping out of trouble mm. and showing them how the court works. And so things are happening, but we haven't got to join them service. Mm.
Hi, my name is Rachel, from the West Coast Association. We're doing a lot of work at the moment around character education, and we had a fringe this morning around sort of how you ensure that young people are able to develop character attributes and where that's best done. And there was a really good point that stuck with me around how you do that with ethos. So this isn't just about teaching someone to be resilient, but how do you do that with an ethos around it? And to me, it feels like it applies to this conversation as well, that actually you can't teach rights and responsibilities unless you do that within an ethos. And mm-hmm. Some schools are doing that and some aren't. So where do you think that can come from? Do you think that sort of the yeah. Labour Party have, I don't know, have a vision for what that ethos would look like.
Okay, right. I'll ask Tracy and Jan to pick up those, and then I'll ask Maurice to do his piece and pick up any of the points as well while we're at it.
So to take Agatha's point about NCS itself, so NCS is in a very lucky position, which is it is a project that is very dear to the Conservative government's heart. And so that we have been told that we'll be funded for the next 3 years. But it is a perpetual, and there are people in this room who have invested enormous amount of time and energy into projects that then reach the end of one funding cycle and then moving to another. And all the learning and the practice and the relationships and, you know, the sense of belonging from the service users just gets lost. And, you know, I'm hopeful at this point that that won't happen to us in the short term. But, you know, there's nothing special about us in that context, which, you know, it could easily happen to us as it does to other organisations. And it does come back to this kind of, you know, what is the long-term vision, which is unless we're prepared to begin to put markers down and say, you know, years of service or, you know, every young person will do this and it won't get undermined, and then you know, we're always going to be in a stop-start situation. And our funding model, which is, I think is quite positive, is that we're a commissioning organisation, we have our money, and then essentially NCS is delivered by local, excellent, fantastic local youth organisations on the whole, not always, but on the whole, who have been part of the community for a very long time. And what you don't get is an identikit model, but what you get is something that's really important to those areas and to those places, and uses local services and local resources. And I think that could be, you know, it could be a very good model going forward. I don't know the answer to how we keep about joining up, but I think it's like crucial. So I've only been in the youth sector for 2 years, and the thing that I find just crazy, and your point wasn't about young people, is how do you know what's out there and how do you access it? And it's almost like there's a market competition with all these fantastic organisations, and you're supposed to be able to negotiate your way around it. And I don't understand why. I don't understand why it's not, you know, our capacity to want to give back is enormous. Yeah. We all understand the double benefit of, you know, societal impact, but also how good it makes us feel to be involved in something. Mm-hmm. And yet we seem to make it so hard to access these things and to find the right fit. So I don't know what the answer is, but I think that if we actually cared enough to find a way to knit all the organisations together and to find pathways between them, I think that would go a long way of creating a new kind of deal between people you know, and society, because I think people do want to do it. There are too many barriers to be able to do that. And the final question was about ethos, and I agree with you. And one of the things that I wrote down earlier, and I didn't say it, about social code, which is one of the things that struck me again working in this kind of youth environment, is how when young people are asked to think about their own behaviour. And it's just young people, but I'm sure it's the same for other people, and to think about how they want to be treated and how they would treat others, very, very clearly there becomes a set of rules that everybody understands and agrees by, and that they're very keen to you know, to hold. I'm actually going to bring my colleague Richard in. Tell us about your five things that the challenge that the young people your ethos,
It's fine.
Yeah, I didn't mean to. Shouldn't have done it. But you know, the young people very quickly will begin to say, "No, that behaviour is not respectful." But it's about where we create that space, where we decide, you know, what the rules are. So I agree with you.
Okay, Jan.
Just a couple of quick things in terms of kings and sustainability, for example. With big organisations, I think the King's model now is sustainable because the board have signed up to it, and every year they allocate quite a lot of money to the volunteering scheme, to training volunteers and to keeping it going. So when it's big organisations, I think you need the decisions to come from the bottom, but ultimately they have to be sanctioned and agreed at the top in order to keep them going. It shouldn't be on the wit of man or woman and women in this digital age, should it, to be able to have a somewhere on the internet or somewhere on a local council site to have information about what's happening in your area vis-a-vis volunteering, and maybe these could all be joined up on some government website somewhere. It should be possible. I know that people have then got to know where to look for the information, but it must be possible. And all those of us who are active in our communities, you're a local councillor, maybe you could go back to the council in Morden and say, what are you doing, Councillor Alan Brittis, about, because I think if we all do that, it certainly will help. Of course, I agree with ethos. The other thing I would add is about leadership, because we talk about, we want people to volunteer and do things with organisations, and young people certainly want to do this. But in the Scouts, I think that there are something like 40,000 young people who want to be Scouts or Cubs, but there are no leaders. So I think that we've got a responsibility as well to talk with our peers to say, hey, you, we want our young people to do things, but we all need to be active in being leaders and training leaders. And the great thing about the NCS is it is actually training leaders for the future.
Thank you. And I'm now very happy to welcome Maurice Glassman, Labour peer, and runs the Faith and Citizenship Programme at London Met, and is also the key author of the Blue Labour Movement. So over to you, Maurice. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Oh, it's a pleasure, and I want to begin with an apology. I think it's what I call a psychosomatic slip. I put it down for tomorrow. It's my daughter's 15th birthday today. So I was halfway to the station when Ed texted me and said it's the Fabian meeting tonight. So I apologise for being late. It was wishful thinking that it was tomorrow, so sorry about that. And I've tried to pick up a bit on what's been said, just to reiterate a couple of things. First of all, what Jan just said is that my experience in community organisation is a systematic approach to leadership development and the leadership of the poor. The leadership of the poor is what we've lost. So we've got an administration of the poor, but we don't develop or support leadership from the communities that we're supposed to represent. And it's very interesting for me, this was all very counterintuitive along my journey. What I realised was that the black church was extremely good at developing leadership from itself. Really, really very good leadership development. I found that in the churches generally, in the Catholic Church, there was very good leadership development from within the congregations who actively became leaders. So it went against my egalitarian instincts at first, this stress on leadership. I thought, leadership was contra to equality. But one of the major paradoxes that I learned was that without leadership, there's no action. And then it comes to who is a leader. And, just to say that the only functional definition, a leader is someone with followers. and that's a very difficult thing in our contemporary politics to understand. But a leader is someone who brings people with them. So when I was working on living wage, for example, it wasn't always the easiest or most compliant or most progressive people who were the leaders in their congregations, in the workforce. But systematic development and training and support. And then the second thing to share with you that I learned, which is very difficult, I think, for Fabians to sometimes fully grasp, is that failure is a necessary part of life, is that not everything works. And the ability to support people when it fails and to evaluate honestly, because the incentive structure that you've got, that everybody's got, is not hospitable to failure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And yet it's a systematic part of your life. Mm-hmm. And you dealt with it very nicely when you said, but it's not always, that not always is, I'm sure about 60% of your working life is difficulties. And that relates to the next point, which is that for various reasons to do with justice and to do with the state and to do with a stress on redistribution, we've been very bad at thinking about character, ethos, and what it takes to... That's the key difficulty, is that we don't have a conception of the enormous amount of time and effort that it takes to develop a sense of mutual responsibility. So we talk about rights and responsibilities. We should definitely be talking about character, reciprocity, learning, because it's still quite transactional, the rights and responsibilities aspect. And just to come to your point about ethos and character, once again, that was a huge humility for me, was to recognise that in faith traditions there was a very strong emphasis on that. And if people, to be able to call people when they did wrong, which in the traditions I was from, much more secular, administrative, we had great difficulty in talking about that. And that means people can't learn, and everything is seen as an administrative issue,
rather
than an issue of ethos. I'm talking about those fundamental issues. But do we have a tradition, you asked? Yeah, you know, the answer is right in the labour movement. So if you look at the history of the labour movement, so, you know, in the 1830s and in the 1840s, with enclosure, with the abolition of any status at work, people were effectively abandoned, homeless, evicted. And their fate was the pauper's grave. And think about the origins of the movement, the burial societies that were created in the cooperative movement. Now, because it's my fate to be very boring and to look at the history of these things, if you look at the history of the co-op, over 90% of the correspondence is about people who don't pay their subs. Right? I mean, it's astonishing. Everything was on contribution. Now, what was astonishing, if you go through the archives, is that people understood totally if there was death, if there was unemployment, all of that was factored in. But if you could contribute and didn't, you were cut out. And it was very straightforward. So the whole history of the movement is that to build associations, you have to have mutual obligation. So that's why I think I got into loads of trouble when I was talking about the problem in 1945, when all this started, is that the problem in 1945 is that it took away the leadership of the poor, it took away association, it took away the basic ways that we created character and leadership in the labour movement in favour of something that we all want, which is perfect procedural justice and an administrative impartiality, except that now we should know that those things are not possible without the active ownership and participation of people in what they do, and the ability to make judgments within organisations about what is and what is not right. So I think that we've got to think very creatively now about how to reconstitute solidarity. So the political reality that we confront as a party is that our greatest achievement, which was the post-war welfare state, is now a site of an amazing degree of contestation. People think it's not fair. People think that they contribute and don't get out, and they think that people get out and don't put in. And these things. So how do we reconstitute solidarity on the basis of what we know as a movement and as a tradition? And the first thing we know as a tradition is that you cannot do it on your own. And very weirdly, the move after 45 was a very big stress on individual and collective, and missing out society, missing out the character forming bit, missing out the mutual contribution bit. So I think that there's really creative work to do in building a balance of power in the corporate governance of hospitals and schools. You know, in hospitals, let's say that a third of the representative on corporate governance should be the funder. They have legitimate interests. A third the workforce and a third users. So that there could be, because we've also got to recognise the real existence of abuse, neglect in institutions and cultures of fear that don't raise those. But how to reconstitute solidarity? The first is, can't do it. Second is, it's got to be recognised that capital centralises and the state centralises and the enormous pressures on funding. So there has to be, if we're going to talk about decentralisation, there has to be the endowment of banks, the endowment of colleges, into local areas so that people have some genuine assets. And then the third thing is that we have to be alert and aware and not cover up when institutions fail. Mm. And that's very hard for us. So, you know, one of the experiences I had the last 5 years is going down to mid-staff, so and asking there what went on, and I spoke to loads of people, from the people who ran the tea shop and the friends of and the unions, and essentially what there was if you brought up any issues, they were worried that they'd lose their funding. Mm. That was it. Mm-hmm. And so from the chaplain, so basically if you spoke out, you were depriving people of your job, of their jobs, and you were actually going to cause death because there would be cuts. Mm,
yeah.
So it's really a massive thing that we've got to be alert and aware to the permanent possibilities of failure and how to have a culture of evaluating failure, a culture of genuine leadership development from the people from the poor.
Yep.
That was the big thing I learned from the Pope. So I was invited to see the Pope, and he
name
said,
dropper.
No, he didn't really know who I was. I said hi, you know, it was one of those, and he said the most important thing. I don't think he'd read my stuff. He said the most important thing I get from your stuff is the leadership of the poor, and I wanted to say I've never really mentioned it. You know, but I didn't want to, you know, ruin the moment. But after that, I got to thinking about that, and that's what. You know, Jan, that citizens thing was about was the thrill of seeing a contracted out cleaner negotiating with the mayor.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
And then to see, that was great to see, but then you looked over and you saw their congregation and their family and the degree of pride that they felt is that, and that is huge, you know, that's a huge cultural change for us in Labour, but that's the only way we're going to reconstitute a solidarity in the welfare system is for people to own it. Mm-hmm. So, and apologies for being late.
No, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Have we got to get out of this room at quarter past?
Thanks. We can probably stretch to half past.
Okay, all
some
right.
People.
Okay.
I think if people want to leave, I think if some people have got to go.
Yeah, yeah. Any comments or particularly questions? And sorry, I saw you as well.
Ross Gard from, I'm a councillor in the London Borough of Merton.
Another one to add to the party. I was the organiser.
I'd just like to say that I think there's great space at the moment, particularly as the panel have commented about the new kind of politics that we seem to be embarking on, for all parties to contribute to this new contract, social contract for the young. I think particularly with this government, the contract has become very lopsided. The government are very good at telling the young people what we want from them. We want them to be model citizens. We want them to take part in these services. But they're not very good at what they can actually do for the young people. So we've seen, as people have mentioned before, the cuts to benefits, not having youth services, a statutory services for local councils. So they're probably the first to go when the cuts are there. And I think there is a great space for us to provide to that argument. I'm not quite sure what the answer is, because I feel that the social contract needs to be in both parties' interests. I think that's a basic premise of any kind of contract. Obviously, there are challenges that have been mentioned, you know, the cuts to funding and everything like that. But I think there needs to be a greater emphasis on what society can do for the young people, especially when they're fall on harder times.
Sarah Church, I had some various comments which will end up the question. Just to talk about the ethos thing, my experience of creating ethos is both in a very formal environment in training 16 and 17 year old soldiers, and then actually, I'm working girl guiding as a hopeful complement to the Scout Association, where each girl guiding unit creates its own set of rules, as you explained, and it's very much about, I think, moving the imposed ethos aside. Yeah. It's very much about that bottom up and creating the space for young people to decide what their ethos actually is. And I think that works best in bounded situations. So you can't have a blanket ethos. Mm-hmm. It's by school or by group, whatever those groups look like. So I think that everything that's being talked about is definitely going down the right road. And I'm hoping it's not going off topic, the thing that I thought might be spoken about a little bit here would be extending suffrage to 16-year-olds, mm-hmm. knowing that we can't do that as a sort of bang, go. What's required, this is a question to the panel, what's required to make that the right thing to do? What, some sort of change or some sort of education or something needs to happen? Because at the moment I think that in schools there isn't a space. People are under so much pressure. I mean, one thing I do find about guiding, and the same with the scouts, is these kids give up in year nine because they cannot add that additional pressure to their lives with all the pressures that are going on, and that's a real shame for them. And I think it takes something away, and it certainly doesn't prepare them to become voters at 16 or 18.
Yeah, in answer to that specific question, the EU bill, we had an amendment in the Commons to extend the vote to 16-year-olds in the EU referendum, and that was lost.
But we're going to win it in the Lords. We are, right. We're definitely going to win it in the Lords.
Brilliant. Okay, so you did, yes, yeah, with the beard, yeah, you had your hand up. Sorry.
Hello, my name's Fred Jerome, I'm a Unison organiser in Bristol. I just wanted to ask about, in terms of the social contract element, you know, contract is sort of between two parties or obviously, what is the state's role in that? Like, what you talked a lot about the brilliant volunteering schemes that there are and so on, but it would seem to me that a new social contract can't simply be about asking young people, any people, to just volunteer more. And you know, it might be that in the past the state people would provide you with cradle to grave welfare services or whatever, on this kind of one size fits all model, which we know doesn't really sort of fit anymore. But now, what's it going to do in terms of the thing's title? Like, who's it going to enable young people, whatever, to exercise their responsibility towards? Is it towards their family? Is it going to give them the time for family life? Or even towards their work colleagues? Like, do your schemes encourage people to join unions, for example? How does the state actually sort of do its bit in the contract?
Thank you. Okay, right, Maurice.
Yeah, so I just, you know, another late arrival spanner in the works. So what we found, so the contract is quite a transactional thing between two reciprocally located parties. And what we found resonated with people much more is to talk about a covenant, which is intergenerational, and to get away from the talk of the contract. And then that brings in, you know, the group. So one thing I've learned, the biggest thing I've learned about being in the Lords was how brilliant it was to be with older people, right? Roughly speaking, it's been a really profound thing for me, because I'm around people who I've seen in my daily lives, people of that age, very weak, retired, isolated, but people with purpose. And how do we bring older people into relationship with young people? So in the policy review that I did with Joel Cruddas, we got told to stop it, so we did. But we wanted to pioneer this thing called Teach Last, which was to bring older people into schools. You know, because there's this Teach First, where apparently if you go to a good university, you can walk into a school and teach.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, it is fantastic. But how about bringing older people into schools? In mentoring and to bring them into relationship, and what we found was a huge resistance to that, and that's to go back to this ethos point. What I learned in organising within churches, within mosques, within gurdwaras, was that there was an active culture of elders who were in relationship with younger people and had a very strong role in, you know, when you say it's not a blank sheet, it really was about, you know, about within a culture of appropriateness and respect. And while initially I found that a bit reactionary, and in fact I could see over time the incredible benefits for the young people in that. And so, Fred, better to think in terms of what constitutes this covenant? What constitutes the giving? How do we bind generations together in a sense of being part of something shared and something mutual and something that can be broken? And what would breaking it constitute? That's where you can't get out of this idea that you've got to give. in order to receive, that's a mutual obligation. And it's an obligation that ties you, that binds you to the future, but also your obligations to older people and to the past. So those are the immediate. Covenant is a rich idea if we can engage with it. Okay.
Tracy?
I thought, Ross, I was going to respond to you by saying that, you know, the issue that I can get consistently told is young people don't vote, which means that they don't have the same currency in politics as other groups of people, and that, you know, it's almost like an excuse, which is, you know, you have to turn up, you have to vote before people are going to take your interests to heart. And I was going to make a point about the fact that you know, young people are going to be the further disenfranchised by the voting registration rules that are going through, and how, you know, something very small, or not small, but something very kind of technical and, you know, can have a profound impact on how resources are allocated for, you know, for young people going forward. But then it just kind of went very nicely to what you were saying about votes at 16, and that, you know, they're kind of the same kind of era. I wasn't a passionate person about votes at 16. I felt, I'll be frank, I felt that was a politician's response to what they felt was wrong. So it's like, well, you know, we want young people to be involved. What we'll do is we'll just lower the voting age, and therefore they'll have to be, rather than actually being something that young people were agitating for themselves. But I have changed my mind a bit on the basis that 16-year-olds, it would appear that if you vote at 16, if where we can still almost like put them in an environment where we can kind of more force them, I'm not saying force, but because they're in a school environment, time and space can be made for that, that once you've voted once, you tend to vote again and again and again and again. And so while I'm not passionate about votes at 16, I understand that once you get them at 16, they might vote at you know, at 20 and 24 and 28, and that is that, you know, for me, it is something that is really kind of important. But I do feel, if I'm honest, that it's a political response to a problem rather than something that young people are desperate for. And in our organisation, when we ever say to young people, votes at 16, they go, nah, you're all right. You know, but to go back to your point, you know, until people start exercising their right, they're not going to get the allocation of resources that they should have, and therefore it's something that we should respond to. And the guy who asked about social contract, I think this is the most important thing. I don't have an answer, but I think it's the single most important thing, which is what are my expectations of living in this society? What can I give, and what can I reasonably expect, and what do I need to give back? And I think that we have lost that conversation, and I think the isolation that some people feel, the fact that, you know, we've got homegrown terrorists, you know, things that are things we don't want to talk about because we don't really understand or feel very comfortable about it. I think that conversation is a really important part of it, which is, you know, what can I expect? You know, we talk about things glibly. Well, a job, somewhere to live, you know, my life will be better than, you know, my kids' lives will be better than my life. These are kind of themes that we all agree on. But I think that conversation is the one that we really need to have. But it's a very, very difficult one to have.
Yeah, it is. And a lot of people don't know what they can give back. And so it is a question of sort of, as Maurice was saying, sort of leadership. All levels of society, including leadership with the poor, so people really do understand what it is to be a citizen, what it is to live in society, because that's what we do. Just briefly, on 16 and 17-year-old votes, I used to be an agnostic, but now I'm passionately in favour, having spoken to lots and lots and lots of young people who are in favour. Ideally, I think it should be combined with better citizenship lessons. But, you know, you just look at what happened in Scotland and how young people got engaged, not just in voting, but they got engaged in the discussions and they became sort of politically engaged. And recently a bill which is now in the House of Commons, which is the devolution bill, when it went through the House of Lords, we inserted an amendment which is for voting for 16 and 17-year-olds in local government elections. I suspect that that will get turned back, but you know, there is certainly will to make a change, and it was our policy, it was in our manifesto, to have votes for 16 and 17-year-olds together with citizenship education and things like the ability to register to vote in schools, which I think is a good thing.
Okay, I'm going to take chair's unilateral action, and I'm going to close the meeting there because I suspect people might want to have a. If you don't have to rush off, want to, but I do. Might want to have a chat with each other. I know a couple of people wanted to come in. There is food at the back that needs eating. Thank you very much. Thank you so much to our three speakers. Thank you to you for your great contribution.
Thank you.
Yes, it was originally
Yes, it was. I got that.